want to talk about Deleuze and Guattari's fantastic book, What is Philosophy? This is really an incredible book, and it's certainly, you know, all things considered, one of the more decipherable, coherent books of theirs, and that is not meant pejoratively either about this book or the other books. Although this book is quite difficult, this is a book where they really are going to try to define philosophy and the practice of philosophy, and they're going to distinguish it from the practice of art and the practice of science. And what they say, standing back, is that these three things, science, philosophy, art, are three kinds of creative enterprises. There are three different ways, different methods, different approaches to creating things in this life. There are no doubt other ways of creating things, but they feel that there is a relationship between art, science, and philosophy, and they want to distinguish between the three. And what they'll say, you know, from the, you know, 1,000 feet standing back, philosophy is the art of creating concepts. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Science is the art of creating functives, functions that explain and distribute, better than explain, distribute states of affairs in the world. It looks at the world and says, these are how things go together in these various ways, such as, you know, physics, Newton, right? And then there's art, which dabbles and deploys percepts, things that can be perceived, which is different than perception, which is something, you know, I and you experience. That's a perception. But art deals in percepts, things that can be perceived, and affect. Also, things that can be perceived, more invisible things, moods, sensations, experiences. So you have these three things. And obviously, the focus of this book is philosophy. And again, they say philosophy is the art of creating concepts. What that means is that philosophy is not the art of discovering concepts, right? I mean, there's a notion of discovery in there, but it's very different. The point being that concepts do not pre-exist, right? They're not these concepts and ideas floating around the world. Nor are there, for Deleuze and Guattari, big questions, right? Philosophy is not the asking of these big questions. It is not the person who sits and reflects and says, oh, what is mind? What is a self? That is not what philosophy is. Philosophy is not reflective. It is creative. Yeah. You know, these big questions that we imagine as philosophy, what is mind? What is self? Those are prefabricated questions. Those were created by somebody. Those are already a philosophy. Right? Another philosophy will pose a different problem. It will ask a different question or a different series of questions. And in response to those questions, right, in an attempt to solve the problem that a philosophy itself has posed, it will offer a concept as a solution. An example that they use is Descartes and the cogito, you know, the I think, therefore I am. They say that is a concept. Descartes' cogito is a concept. And it is a solution to the problem of the doubter, right? So what Descartes does is he says, okay, you know, he's imagining this world of skeptics, and he's bought into this world of skepticism, in which there is this sort of relentless, infinite doubt, right? I can doubt everything. I can doubt that my body exists. I can doubt my senses. I can doubt that you're even there. I can doubt everything. So how do I know anything, including how can I know that there's being? So Descartes thinks about that, and then he realizes that in his doubting, he is still thinking, and therefore he must be being. which is a hilarious sentence. You know, we can come along and critique Descartes' cogito and say, well, what is an I? What is thinking? What is doubt? Which is what a lot of, you know, postmodern philosophical critiques will do of Descartes' concept. But for Deleuze and Guattari, that's sort of a silly exercise. It's an exercise you would only do in the act of creating your own concept and to distinguish it from Descartes. Because within Descartes' world, right, within the field he has laid out, the cogito is perfect. It solves the problem that he himself framed. Right? Philosophy does not answer big questions. Each philosopher invents a question they might not even know they're asking. They are addressing a problem that they see, not that pre-exists. Right? Not that's a fundamental problem. The question of self is not a fundamental problem. Right? You might have a philosophy that for which there never was a self. We are always already a collective. There already is a collective mind. Maybe there's no such thing as self. Therefore, the question, what is a self, is literally irrelevant. It's insane. It's moot. It's outside the realm of discussion. For Deleuze and Guattari, there are these big questions are not the questions of philosophy. They're the questions of a different kind of practice, which in which they are not interested and we are not interested here. Their vision involves all these different philosophers laying out these different problems, asking different questions, and then creating within that milieu, within that scene that they've cast, a concept as a solution to the problem that they have stated. What this means, of course, is that it's not a matter of assessing a concept by its truth. Right? A concept for Deleuze and Guattari is not a matter of knowledge. It's not a matter of truth, precisely because knowledge and truth are themselves concepts that would fit into a philosophy. But your philosophy might not have such things, such as Nietzsche's philosophy, right? For which truth is just another argument, right? It is not the goal. The will to truth is a figure within Nietzsche's philosophy. So for them, we make sense of concepts, not by their error or their falsehood or their truthhood, but by whether they are interesting, remarkable, and important. And that's, I love that, right? Because at first, is it interesting? Does it provoke you? You know, and I think about my relationship to Kant, you know, and I read Kant's Third Critique, and I'm by no means a Kantian expert. I don't know what that would even mean, but I really loved reading that book, and I've taught Kant's chapter on the beautiful many times, and I love the moves it makes, and how it explains how we can assess something as beautiful, make the claim about that thing being beautiful, even though we know it's subjective, and he goes through these incredibly convoluted moves, these elaborate gestures to explain it. I by no means think Kant is right. You know, I don't believe him in the sense that I don't think that's what happens when I assess something. But I love it. It's a beautiful thing. I love the sense it makes. And in fact, it's deranged. There's such a bizarre logic at work there, right? By becoming so rational, by insisting on rationality so much, Kant ends up with these very deranged logics that, again, I think are very beautiful, much like a sculpture is beautiful. Except that the sculpture here is gossamer, is concept. right, is aspects of concepts. It's not an object, right? But it is this beautiful thing. Only it's an invisible thing. It is a concept. Important is another word they use, another sort of criterion by which to assess a concept. And I think it's worth thinking about this notion of the important, because there are all sorts of concepts. There are, and they talk about in the book is, you know, advertising and marketing talks a lot about concepts, you know, and I work in the branding field, and this is what we talk about. I go into work with a company, and they have all these attributes, and they don't know quite how to bring it all together. And so I give them a concept. I say, this is how it all hangs together. And I take all these different components and I make this thing. And that might or might not be interesting. It's in the grand scheme of things, it's probably not very important, although it's important for that client and for them making some money. But for Deleuze and Guattari, what they mean by important is, does the concept, does the philosophy radically shift the very way in which we think about thinking, or what they call the image of thought? I love this figure, the image of thought. You know, Descartes gives us an image of thought. He's alone in a room. He's shut out the world. He's playing with wax. He's reflective. And that's a really beautiful, classic image of the philosopher. But Nietzsche gives us a very different image of thought. Right? Nietzsche says, never trust an idea that comes while sitting. And he claims he thought up, you know, he basically wrote all of Zarathustra on a brisk walk, you know, one morning through the countryside, through the woods. Those are two very different images of thought, of what it is to be thinking. And they've laid out two very different fields of problems and issues, right? For Nietzsche, he's really interested in the affirmation of this life and of the body. And he's trying to reckon his own sickness and what it means to be vomiting phlegm for 3 days and have migraines. And how do I, you know, he's trying to deal with all the sort of douchebags he has to deal with in the academy and he finds all around him. Descartes is very different. He's willing to put down the body and come to the body first through thought. And neither one is correct per se. They each make sense in their own worlds. And this is where we get the notion, the phrase, the concept, perhaps, that Deleuze and Guattari have of what they call the plane of immanence. Plane of immanence. And it's a figure that comes back for them a lot. And it's very strange. Plane of immanence is the sort of field. And they say that's what a philosopher does. He lays down a field of purview. These are the types of things I'm going to be thinking about. And these are the things I am thinking about. They might not be totally conscious. A philosopher might not be able to say, this is my plane of immanence. But he always operates within a plane of immanence. Now, this plane of immanence is sort of all the stuff, all the fragments of possibilities, the historical knowledge, the fragments of other philosophers, the pieces and the way they've read other philosophers and things have come to them, and all their weird perceptions and intuitions that have sort of driven them and motivated them and informed who they are and how they think since they were born. And within all that stuff, all these fragments of ideas and glimmers and images and little facts they know, brains and bodies and flesh and thinking and the Platonic ideal and Socrates as this great nudge and suicide and Christianity, whatever they have just floating around in there. And they somehow see this field of in which they are situated and in which they see various problems arise that they for which they will invent concepts as solutions. This plane of immanence is at once sort of theirs, but it's also not theirs. It's out there. It's their perspective. So in that sense, it's theirs, but it's also, you know, Descartes' field of immanence is also partially Plato's, right, and partially Heraclitus, and partially the skeptics, and they all overlap and weave in and out of each other. And what the philosopher is doing is creating a logic that is immanent, meaning it doesn't need to solve a meta problem, a problem outside of this world. All the terms within a particular philosophy, the problems, the questions, the figures, the concepts, are all immanent to this plane. They are of this plane, essentially. And what Deleuze and Guattari go out of their way to say in explaining this strange notion of a plane of immanence is that there's no immanent to something. This is not immanent to something else, precisely because there is no something else. The one thing that they will resist at every turn, Deleuze and Guattari, is transcendence. This book is an attempt to define the philosophical practice without transcendence. What that means is when they look at the history of philosophy, they see all these various moves to explain all this stuff through a term that's not part of this stuff, such as God. God is a figure that won't be implicated in this world. You could say maybe Plato's idea, right, is an attempt at transcendence, right? The idea or the form for Plato is outside of all this stuff. But what Deleuze and Guattari do is fold it back into this stuff and claim that the Platonic idea, the Platonic form, is not an essential term in and of itself. It's an essential term to Plato's field of immanence. It is immanent to Plato and Platonism, but not to truth or philosophy per se. Okay? They will resist transcendence at every turn because transcendence for them is the end of thought, right? This is the truly Nietzschean element that runs through these guys, right? That the belief that transcendence is a negation of this life. It's an attempt to leave this life, to transcend the matters of this life, and thereby efface, annihilate, deface what's here. And that is negative. It's sickly. It's ill will, right, in the Nietzschean sense. It's bad thought. And what they are interested in this book is a model of philosophy that fosters good thought, right? That fosters good feeling. That doesn't mean there isn't conflict and mayhem and all sorts of things, but it is, there will be no transcendence for them, no way out. All there is this life. And for each philosopher, they are seeing the world from their perspective and phrasing and situating themselves within a milieu of knowledge and history and other philosophers and scraping together these pieces and these strange intuitions about the way things are. And that is this plane of immanence. Now within this field of immanence, this sort of morass, this miasma of perceptions, fragments of other philosophers, images, knowledge, the philosopher creates a concept. And in a sense, a concept is this tenuous sense within nonsense, this precarious structure within chaos. It is the hedging of chaos. And this is the figure Deleuze and Guattari come back to. This is a problem for them. It's the problem that they lay out in their plane of immanence. They see chaos and then the formation of structures, right? In Thousand Plateaus, the chapter that I've always felt the closest to is the chapter on the refrain in music, in the bird song, and the way music forms a structure, the way the refrain and this repetition with difference forms a structure out of chaos, out of all the noise. It begins to sort of cohere and take this shape, but it can always dissipate. It can always dissipate and just become noise again. And this is true of a concept as well. Concept is this precarious thing that sort of hangs together only with, you know, very tenuously and only within the structure, that if you interrogate or try to explain, let's say, something as familiar as Descartes' Cogito, it actually becomes insane. You know, yeah. If you weren't somebody versed in the whole practice and history of philosophy and all of its institutional trappings, someone who tried to explain to you, oh, you know, nothing exists, but I doubt that things exist. Therefore, I'm still thinking. Therefore, I am. And if I am, that must have come from somewhere. So, that must have come from God, and God's not going to fool me. So, I must have a body. Come on, that's freaking insane, right? It's demented. Although the one thing it's actually not is insane, because if we define the insane as the incoherent, right, or the chaotic, it is a very special kind of madness. It is this coherence, precarious coherence within this field of chaos. And when you're reading Deleuze and Guattari's book, they really perform that. This book is incredible in that it performs this. This tenuous hedging of chaos, these formations. You get this flicker of what the heck they're talking about before it dissipates again, and it's you feel the difficulty, you feel the tenuous nature of a concept which is all gossamer amidst the torrent of cosmic forces that is a plane of immanence, to create sense from nonsense, to create something from nothing. Oh, that's not quite right. To create sense from chaos, to create this shape, this possibility, this configuration, when it could all just give way, right, to gobbledygook at any moment. And their book, you know, What is Philosophy, itself always feels like it's about to give way to gobbledygook. It's just hanging together. They're talking about very peculiar things in these very peculiar ways, planes of immanence, and concepts which are multiplicities that involve these different elements that will hang together at the speed at an infinite speed of thought. And you're like, what the heck are you talking about? And, you know, reading this, I remembered, you know, I hadn't read this book in a long time, and I just reread it for a podcast I was part of on the Partially Examined Life, in which we're all discussing this book. But I remembered just how strange philosophy is, you know? And, you know, you can say, well, I really get Deleuze and Guattari, I really get Nietzsche. But there's enormous components that I find incomprehensible and bizarre, and I have no freaking idea what they're talking about. And that's true of every philosopher, for everybody. You know, for the greatest Kantian expert, there are still moments that are just strange. And they might have an explanation about what's going on there. But the fact is, every philosophy is very strange, right? It's, you know, only through the sort of institutional practices of normalizing it does it become something we feel like we can even talk about sanely and not sound like raving lunatics, right? It's the same with art. You know, you look at a Pollock and he's scattering this paint on a canvas. You're like, what the hell are you doing, dude? What the hell are you doing, right? Or create this elaborate, luscious, you know, classical scene of rape, which seems to be a very common thing to have done. I don't even know the history of art when they were painting all those things. What a strange thing to do. What a strange thing to do. But within an institution of art and somehow within the field of immanence, in a sense, or the field of affective perceptual practice that Pollock could have operated, he's scattering this paint on a canvas, putting the canvas on the floor, not looking at anything but the canvas, right? For instance, not looking at an object as it to portray it, sort of overcoming all mimetic aspects or components of art, just to make art an event of splattering paint on a canvas over and against any object. The object is the paint. The object is the canvas, right? There is no other object other than the act of painting. Well, that makes perfect sense, you know, from the perspective of Jackson Pollock. And, you know, studying the history of modern art, we can say, yes, this makes sense. It's the same with philosophy. You know, philosophy is very, very strange. It's very personal. It's very idiosyncratic. And you read What is Philosophy, it's a tough book. It's a strange book. And what Deleuze and Guattari give us is this proliferation of strange perspectives. Rather than philosophers all working together to understand what is mind, or rather than the history of philosophy being a series of arguments or perspectives on a common issue, it is this proliferation of worlds, that each philosophy is a possible world, is another world. It comes to you, like they use in their book, as a face and says, I am this world. This is how it goes. This is how the world goes, says Kant. Descartes says, this is how the world goes. And Deleuze and Guattari say, this is how the world goes. And Nietzsche says, this is how the world goes. They're not all trying to answer the same question. What Deleuze and Guattari give us is this multiplicity, philosophy as a multiplicity, with each philosopher and each philosophy being the center. Right? Each philosophy poses a problem again and anew. It's not the same problem. It's always a new and different problem. Right? You don't have to read a philosophy and say, I agree with that or disagree with that. You read a philosophy and you say, is this interesting? Is this remarkable? Is this important? Does this change the way I think about thinking? Of what I imagine, what I see, how I practice, what it means to be something that thinks. One of the things I really took away from this book was that image of thought. And when they talk about art, and art really is this deployment of percept and affect. And it's not that art doesn't have concepts. It's that art doesn't deal first and foremost with concepts. And what we call conceptual art is not really about concepts. I don't actually want to get into that. Philosophers aren't inventing concepts, right? Conceptual art is really art that functions at the level of abstraction, maybe, but not necessarily of the concept per se. But what I began to understand is that when an artist paints or dances or makes a film or writes, that artist is thinking, right? What we imagine is thinking this old image of the philosophical mind contemplating big issues. That is actually, for Deleuze and Guattari, not thinking. Thinking for them is this creative move, this creative gesture, this constructive practice of hedging chaos to create these fragments, these shapes, these precarious constellations, these splatters of paint, these concepts that solve problems,